You're listening to a CME CE presentation from The Body Pro. For more continuing education activities, please visit us online at www.thebodypro.com/CME.
Hi, this is Dr. David Hardy. I'm the director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center and also Associate Professor of Medicine at the David Geffen School of Medicine, both in Los Angeles, California. I'm going to be discussing the new class of medications called CCR5 antagonist or co-receptor antagonist. But before I actually go into the details of those clinical trials, I first of all wanted to just give some background about how chemokine co-receptors are involved in HIV entry, how they evolve over the course of HIV infection, and also how they set up a new target for the treatment of HIV infection. As you all well know, our targets for treatment of HIV infection have relied primarily upon viral targets, enzymes that are useful in reproducing the virus once it has entered into a CD4 positive T cell. We currently have one licensed medication that's also considered to be an entry inhibitor called enfuvirtide, which blocks viral fusion after the virus has sufficiently attached to the outside of a CD4 positive T cell and is now pushing its way inside that cell. As you can see from this slide, the retroviral life cycle has really provided us a multitude of many targets for which we have exploited several of them in terms of reverse transcriptase inhibitors, protease inhibitors, fusion inhibitors, and also now a new class of medications called co-receptor inhibitors as well. Another new class of medications recently brought to market in the United States and many countries around the world are the integrase inhibitors, blocking the viral integration into the host cell genome. Finally, an experimental class of medication still in development called maturation inhibitors, which are in phase 2, phase 3 studies currently. What we're going to focus on today is going to be co-receptor biology of HIV and also how this target can be therapeutically useful to us in terms of blocking the earliest steps of viral entry outside a human T cell. HIV entry is composed of probably at least three steps. These steps, as we're going to look at them today, are sequential steps, but they may actually kind of overlap and have different sorts of activity over time. As we can see here, the first step in HIV entry is the CD4 cell binding, in which the CD4 cell protein on the outside of a T cell, first of all, binds to a specific part of this GP120 viral protein, the outside glycoprotein. A part of the GP120 molecule that was previously unexposed becomes exposed through a conformational change that's caused by the initial CD4 cell binding, which makes the V3 loop available for binding to the second particle on the outside of a human T cell called the chemokine receptor. We'll talk more about chemokine receptors in a few minutes. After the virus is then firmly attached to the cell by both CD4 and chemokine receptor binding, the virus then basically harpoons the cell with its GP41 protein, shown in red in the slide. And then after this, the GP41 basically folds over on itself, allowing for close contact between the viral envelope and the plasma cell membrane, so that these membranes then basically fuse and allow for the genetic material and enzymes of HIV to be pushed inside the human cell, and thus infection has occurred. There are many molecules that have been developed to block CD4 cell binding, as well as co-receptor binding, and also as well as fusion. Enfuvirtide is our licensed medication for blocking the fusion step. We now have one licensed medication called Maraviroc, as I approved CCR5 antagonist, a second in development called Vicrovirok, and then several molecules, as we see now here on this slide, that are still in either preclinical or clinical testing. Let's break this down a little bit more to kind of get a better feeling for really what the biology of the interaction between a human T cell and HIV are all about. This slide shows the surface of a CD4 positive T cell and basically shows the triad of how the CD4 molecules shown here in pink and the chemokine receptors, either CCR5 shown in orange or CXCR4 here shown in green, are configured on the outside of a human T cell. As you can see, these molecules are all put in a grouping of three or a triad, so that it really takes triple binding each time for this interaction between virus and human T cell to occur. Next slide shows basically how the viral particle is now descending upon a human T cell, and we can see the outermost part of the particle called the glycoprotein 120, GP120 on the outside of the virus, getting closer and closer to the CD4 molecule. When these two molecules become very close, you can see that there is a specific binding between GP120 and the three CD4 cell molecules. This creates a conformational change, which basically flips open the part of the GP120 molecule previously hiding the V3 loop. The V3 loop is now exposed, and with this exposure comes a second binding of the GP120 molecule and the chemokine receptor, in this case, a CCR5 molecule. This is actually done in triplicate, as one can see, to really firmly bind the viral particle to the human T cell. Once firmly bound, one can see that there's a quick and efficient harpooning of the human T cell by GP41. And with that, the folding over of the GP41 molecule, pulling the envelope of the virus close to the plasma membrane of the cell, fusion occurs between these two surfaces, and with this, a pore is created, allowing for the entrance of the HIV RNA and other associated enzymes into the human T cell, and thus infection has occurred. Let's move on now to a natural history about tropism. This is a fairly new science. It was first discovered about 10 to 12 years ago and has offered us a huge new understanding of how HIV interacts with our human T cells. CCR5 and CXCR4 are chemokine receptors. Chemokine receptors are expressed on the outside of immune cells and other antigen-presenting cells. They allow these cells to be able to interact with each other through chemoattractive cytokines. Cytokines such as MIP-1-alpha, MIP-1-beta, and RANTES are all some of the molecules that are the natural ligands or binders of these chemokine receptors. HIV has been able to evolve to where it can also utilize these chemokine receptors, not as immune correspondents, but actually as a way to bind and get inside the cell, as we saw before. We know that the normal function of chemokine receptors is to allow for T-cell migration to different inflammatory areas, as well as immune response to the various antigens. This next slide shows basically how CCR5 and CXCR4, the two most commonly used chemokine receptors for HIV infection, are actually very similar in terms of they are 7 transmembrane proteins, meaning that they traverse the human T-cell plasma membrane 7 times and have both an intracellular and extracellular regions. Those extracellular regions are important in terms of the specificity of the amino acids within them, which allow the HIV virus to recognize and attach in a very specific way. CCR5 viruses, known for short, just R5 viruses, are what we used to call M-tropic, macrophage-tropic, or NSI, non-syncytium-inducing viruses. These viruses make up for about 98 to 99% of all new infections of HIV and are prevalent early in HIV infection and disease. CXCR4 viruses, or for short, X4 viruses, are also known as T-tropic, T-cell-tropic, or SI, syncytium-inducing viruses. As we know from studies of the evolution of HIV infection, these viruses emerge late in HIV disease and have been associated with rapid CD4 cell decline. We also know that there are certain viruses called mixed or dual tropic viruses. This slide shows how X4 viruses infect primarily T cell lines by using the CXCR4 coreceptor on those cells, and also primary lymphocytes such as naive and memory CD4 cells. R5 viruses infect primarily macrophage, monocytes, and dendritic cells, which allows for some of the reason why new infections are associated with this type of virus. Primary lymphocytes can express both CXCR4 and CCR5 over different stages of their lifetime. A dual-tropic virus then would be able to infect this kind of cell because it expresses both co-receptors. We've learned over time some very interesting genetics of the CCR5 gene. As you all know, we receive an allele from each parent of CCR5, and it's been determined that about 5 to 14% of Caucasians, primarily from Northern European descent, carry a specific deletion in the CCR5 gene called Delta 32, which makes half of that person's genes unable to express the CCR5 protein. In addition, we've also learned that about 1% of persons have dual Delta 32 deleted genes from each one of their parents and are considered to be CCR5 Delta 32 homozygotes. This means that their T cells cannot express any CCR5 molecules on their surface and therefore are basically unable to be infected by CCR5 tropic virus. They can, however, become infected from an X4 virus. Interestingly, the origin of this CCR5 Delta 32 allele has been traced back to European geography, first thought to occur about 1,000 years ago, and possibly as a positive selection against a pandemic pathogen such as smallpox or perhaps the bubonic plague, something that in persons who did not have wild-type genes but rather had Delta 32 deleted genes were those who survived the bubonic plague or smallpox. As one can see from this map, areas of Europe where the Delta 32 prevalence is high are in Northern Europe. It decreases going southward through Central and Southern Europe. Seems to be also rather high in areas where migration occurred from Northern Europe in the U.S., Canada, and also Australia, and seems to be very rare in other parts of the world such as Africa, Asia, and South America. Persons who are considered to be perhaps wild-type or normal, these individuals have wild-type genes from both parents, have a normal amount of CCR5 expression on their T-cells, normal progression of HIV infection if infected, and also have normal immune function. Persons who are heterogeneous for this gene containing one wild-type and one Delta 32 allele also have CCR5 expression, but in a decreased amount, probably half of what the normal persons have. This can be associated with HIV infection, but with delayed progression and CD4 cell depletion and AIDS and death. These persons also have normal immune functions. And finally, in the situation when both alleles are Delta 32 in origin, these individuals have no CCR5 expression on their T cells, therefore cannot be infected with an R5 tropic virus, can have rare infection, however, with X4 tropic virus, but interestingly do have normal immune function. There's been some concern that in individuals who are homozygotes for Delta 32 may not have entirely normal immune function, in that a small handful of cases of individuals who developed neurologic involvement with West Nile infection in some parts of the United States. Patients who have been followed over time and who are known to be heterozygous for the CCR5 Delta 32 gene have shown that there's a slower time to progression to developing AIDS and also slower time to death, statistically different from individuals who are wild type for this gene, indicating that there's some protection that seems to occur with the decrease in the amount of available CCR5. And of course, this starts to provide some therapeutic decision making as to how this decrease in CCR5 expression could be used in a therapeutic nature. In order for us to better understand how we can characterize viruses, a new assay called the tropism assay has been developed. This assay is, I think, a further extension in better characterizing individual patients' viruses in order to be able to better understand what the progression of that patient's disease may be with HIV infection, and also to understand better what kind of therapeutic agents, in this case CCR5 antagonists, may or may not be effective in treating that patient. A tropism assay is, in fact, required before one decides to use a CCR5 antagonist. Individuals who have CCR5 tropic virus will be expected to respond well to an HIV regimen containing a CCR5 antagonist. Those who have either dual mixed or primarily X4 type virus would not be expected to respond well to a CCR5 containing regimen. Let's look at the assay that's now available in the United States and has been clinically validated in terms of being used in pretty much all of the currently completed and ongoing treatment protocols with R5 and X4 antagonists. The tropism assay is a further use of the platform developed for the phenotypic expression of resistance to reverse transcriptase inhibitors and protease inhibitors, and been available for some many years. Basically, what they do is to create a viral vector using the patient's envelope gene and cloning that into with another vector called a luciferase expression vector, which allows for light to be emitted in a infected cell. When these two vectors are transfected or forced to go inside of a virus-producing cell, particles called pseudovirions are generated, which will express what a patient's envelope glycoproteins actually will show. These viruses are then put in contact with two different kinds of cells. both of these cells express CD4 molecules on the surface, and then some express either CCR5 or CXCR4. When these pseudovirions are put into contact with these cells, either the cells can infect the CCR5 expressing cells and not the CXCR4 positive cells, and therefore this virus would be characterized as being a CCR5 or R5 COVID virus. If the virus infects only the CXCR4 expressing cells, we know that this virus is then only an X4 virus because it cannot and does not infect the CCR5 expressing cells. However, in the case in which the virus population can infect both of these cells, CCR5 and CXCR4 expressing cells, this is either a dual tropic virus or a mixed population of viruses that contain both R5 and X4 tropic viruses. Let's look at how this can actually occur in terms of what the tropism test can tell us. As this next slide shows in graphic form, an R5 virus in the orange there will infect a CCR5 expressing cell. Light generated when the viral particle infects a cell and a readout of light expression is shown to be positive. When the same virus then tries to infect an X4 expressing cell, it cannot attach to the cell and therefore no light is generated. Let's look at a dual tropic virus. This virus expresses both CCR5 and CXCR4 binding molecules on its surface and therefore can infect both an R5 virus, as shown here, as well as infect an X4 virus, shown here, with light expressed from both cell populations. Finally, we can also look at a population of viruses, as shown in this slide, in which there's viruses that are R5, some are X4, and some are dual viruses, and therefore when it comes up to the R5 virus, it can infect that and express life. And this virus population can also infect the X4 virus and express life. Just as a little quiz, what kind of population do we see here? We see primarily R5 tropic viruses, but behind there's kind of hidden behind is one X4 virus. So this population can infect both R5 expressing cells, and in smaller numbers also infect the X4 expressing cells. This really points out how important it is to be able to detect not so much the R5 population, but primarily the X4 population, especially when we're talking about whether or not we can use currently licensed class of medications called R5 inhibitors. Because what we really want to know is how much X4 virus is actually in that population that may not be affected by the R5 antagonist. This next slide shows how this tropism test has been improved since it was made available about a year ago. The old test had the sensitivity of being able to detect down to a 10% minimum of X4 expressing virus, meaning that it could detect the population if it was 10% or greater of X4, but if it was less than 10%, this assay was not able to accurately identify those low levels of X4 virus. With some specific sort of enhancements, this assay has now been improved so that it can actually now detect down to a X4 using virus population of around 0.3%, markedly increasing the sensitivity of this assay to be able to identify any X4 virus that may be in the viral population and therefore more accurately characterize what the tropism of this population will be and therefore what kind of medications would work well against it. We know that co-receptor tropism evolves over time, and let's look at some of the epidemiologic data that we have available to us in terms of seeing how this actually happens. From several cohorts of patients who were naive to therapy but about to start therapy, we know that the majority of the viruses contained in these persons is R5 virus, somewhere between 80 to almost 90% of naive HIV-positive patients will have R5 tropic virus. Smaller proportion, somewhere between 10 to as high as 20%, will have dual mixed virus. A very small population, less than 1%, will have only X4. Over time, what we actually notice is that co-receptor usage actually evolves. And when we look at populations of patients who are considered to be treatment experienced, some of them very highly treatment experienced, as shown in this slide from the Toro population and also the Motivate 1 and 2 studies, we see that in these highly treatment experienced patients, the usage of R5 viruses actually decreases from 80 to 90% down to around 40 to 50%. The proportion of patients' viruses that use R5 and X4 actually increases to around 40 to 50%. And X4 only using viruses increases a bit to somewhere between 2 to 4%. This evolution of tropism usage occurs over the course of HIV treatment history, and whether or not it's caused by that is really not clearly understood. What we do know about tropism usage by HIV from this study by Broom and others is that as the CD4 cell count decreased, the use of X4 increased. The mean CD4 cell count in patients who had X4 virus was 110 versus a median CD4 cell count of 290 in those who had R5 using viruses. Viral load is also a bit higher, 175,000 copies versus 120,000 copies in X4 versus R5 virus, respectively. Whether or not the use of X4 is caused by the drop in CD4 cell count is still not clearly understood. All we know for sure right now is that these two things are in fact associated. What happens in terms of patients who are determined to be R5 or X4 over time? What happens when they get treated in terms of response to heart regimens? A cohort of patients in London in which individuals naive to therapy and followed over time for the progression of HIV infection had their viruses tested for tropism. 402 naive patients, 326 were found to be R5, 73 were found to have dual mixed virus, and 3 patients were found to have X4. By August of 2006, 340 of these 402 patients had started on heart therapy. 229 of the R5 virus patients, 60 of the dual mixed patients, and 51 had been excluded from analysis for various reasons. Let's look at the 2-year follow-through of these patients who were determined to have R5 or X4 virus. Looking at their CD4 cell count progression over time, a statistically greater fall in CD4 cell count occurred in those patients who were found to have some X4 virus in their viral population over 2 years of no treatment follow-up. However, when treatment was in fact initiated in these patients, the proportion of patients achieving a viral load less than 50 copies of becoming undetectable was in fact no different in these patients whether they had R5 or a dual mixed X4 containing viral population, showing that there does seem to be some natural history difference between these two viral populations, but no real difference in terms of treatment. A similar sort of study was actually done in those patients in the Toro study who were R5 only or X4 containing viral populations. In terms of response to therapy, there was in fact no difference in terms of X4 or R5 tropic viruses. As this slide shows, in terms of response rates to heart, and those patients who are R5 tropic or had some X4 tropic virus, the CD4 cell rise at 12 and 24 months was really no different. In terms of proportion of patients who had undetectable virus at 12 or 24 months was really no different as well. So both by immunologic as well as virologic criteria, really no difference in terms of treatment response, whether it's R5 or X4 virus. Now let's move on to some of the clinical trials with CCR5 antagonists. There is one agent that has been approved by the FDA called Maraviroc, specifically for patients who are highly treatment experienced. The Motivate 1 and 2 studies is responsible for licensure of this medication in the U.S. and in several countries throughout the world. Motivate 1 and 2 are international ongoing trials that enrolled a little over 1,000 patients worldwide. These patients had to have triple-class experience or proven triple-class resistance to nucleosides, non-nucleosides, and protease inhibitors. All these patients were, at screening, determined to have R5 tropic viruses to be entered into this trial with this R5 antagonist. All patients were given an optimized background therapeutic regimen based upon a baseline genotype, phenotype, and T20 sensitivity assays. Added to that optimized background regimen was placebo, Maraviroc given once a day, or Maraviroc given twice a day. This next slide shows some of the baseline characteristics of the patients enrolled in the study. Now, these individuals were in their mid to late 40s. Around 10 to 12% were female. The majority, around 80-85%, were Caucasian. CD4 cell counts in these three arms of the study were all less than 200. The viral loads were somewhere around 70,000 to 80,000, and the majority of patients, two-thirds of the patients, had less than 2 active drugs in their background optimized regimen. Around 40 to 45% of patients received T20 as part of their regimens, and a very small number of patients, around 12 to 15%, received tipranovir. Of note, darunavir, our newest protease inhibitor, was not allowed to be used in the study because of lack of knowledge of the drug-to-drug interaction between Maraviroc and darunavir. The bottom line is that the difference in the primary endpoint of suppression of viral load from baseline to week 48 showed a statistically and clinically significant greater viral load suppression with both doses of Maraviroc, either given once a day or twice a day, compared to placebo. The difference was almost one log between placebo and both arms of the Maraviroc-treated patients. Here's the secondary endpoints, a proportion of patients who had less than 400 copies or less than 50 copies of virus at week 48, averaging around 43% to 45% in the Maraviroc arms compared to just under 17% in the patients receiving placebo. There was almost a tripling in terms of better suppression with Maraviroc-containing regimens. The CD4 cell count increase in this patient was also of note at 48 weeks. The Maraviroc arms both had well over 100 new CD4 cells increased compared to baseline, 124 for the Maraviroc twice-a-day arm, 116 average increase in CD4 cell count for the once-a-day Maraviroc arm compared to 61 cells for the placebo arm. As we can also see here, there was a difference in terms of where the patient's baseline viral load was as they started. However, there was significant increases in terms of better viral load suppression with Maraviroc compared to placebo, whether the patient's viral load was above or below 100,000. Similar sort of results are seen based upon baseline CD4 cell count. There was better suppression of HIV based upon the number of CD4 cells at baseline with both Maraviroc arms compared to placebo. However, this did vary as the CD4 cell count increased, becoming increasingly better with more CD4 cells, as one might expect. This trend is something that has been seen in pretty much all of our treatment-experienced protocols. One of the most interesting things I think about this medication is that its adverse event profile seems to be very good. Although the total exposure time to the Maraviroc versus placebo was in fact different, almost three times longer in the Maraviroc-treated patients, the proportion of patients having any kind of treatment-emergent adverse events leading to discontinuation of therapy, serious adverse events, Category C, new AIDS events, or malignancies, there was really no difference between the Maraviroc-treated patients and those receiving placebo. One concern, of course, about this class of agents has been what effect it may have on the liver. As one can see here, the proportion of patients in the Maraviroc arms compared to the placebo arms was really no different for both grade 3, grade 4 increases in AST, ALT, or total bilirubin, indicating really no significant signal of any kind of hepatic toxicity with this agent. In terms of patient-reported adverse events, what we can see here is that the most common events that usually occur in clinical trials with antiretroviral agents, such as diarrhea, nausea, fatigue, headache, were really no different between those patients receiving Maraviroc or those receiving placebo. The things that did stand out that were more commonly associated with Maraviroc treatment were, in fact, upper respiratory tract infection, cough, and nasopharyngitis. One of the hypotheses of this, why this occurred this way, was simply that Maraviroc patients were on treatment longer, that the opportunity for them to develop a seasonal URI was greater than those patients who were in the placebo arm who stopped medication more quickly. In summary, the MOTIVATE 1 and 2 studies showed us that Maraviroc was an effective agent when added to an optimized background regimen compared to placebo in suppressing viral load by almost an additional log, almost doubling CD4 cell count increases, and being associated with few, if any, significant adverse events, either patient-reported or laboratory events, and has a very good tolerance and toxicity profile. A second CCR5 antagonist is also in clinical development, a medication called Vicroviroc, being developed in also treatment-experienced patients, has been shown in a phase 2B clinical trial to have significant antiviral activity. Patients who were triple class experienced with nucleosides, non-nucleosides, and protease inhibitors, and also determined to be CCR5 tropic in terms of viral tropism, were randomized to optimized background regimen along with Vicroviroc dosed at 20 milligrams once a day, 30 milligrams once a day, or a placebo. Of note, all patients' optimized background regimen did have to contain a ritonavir boost PI because of the boosting effect that ritonavir has on Vicroviroc that allows for lower doses to be used on a once-a-day basis. At 48 weeks of follow-up, we see a significant decrease in viral load in the two Vicroviroc arms of approximately 1.75, 1.77 log compared to baseline, which is almost an additional one log increase over those patients who were receiving placebo. The proportion of patients who had viral loads less than 50 copies at 48 weeks was 56% in the 30 milligram arm, 53% in the 20 milligram arm, compared to only 14% in those patients that received placebo, showing a more than tripling effect in terms of the addition of Vicrovirox to an optimized background medication. There's really no significant clinical differences in adverse events seen between Vicrovirox and placebo, and really no difference in terms of laboratory abnormalities as well. This study was a small study containing about 60 patients per arm, and therefore the phase 3 trial of this medication is to be done and will be done in comparison to the only agent also in this class that has been approved called Maraviroc, as we saw before. As one might expect, perhaps one of the best places to use CCR5 antagonists is where that type of virus, an R5 type of virus, is most common, and that is in patients who are naive to therapy. The MERIT study is a trial that is still ongoing, but actually looked at the comparison of Maraviroc plus Zidovudine plus 3TC versus efavirenz plus Zidovudine and 3TC in treatment-naive patients. All these patients were determined to have R5 tropic virus at screening into the trial and were followed in a very stringent non-inferiority-based study to see whether or not the Maraviroc arm was, in fact, non-inferior to the efavirenz-containing arm. This study was stratified not only by whether or not the baseline RNA was above or below 100,000 copies, but also by where the patient was treated in the northern or southern hemisphere, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. In terms of the primary endpoint in this study, looking at proportion of patients that had viral loads less than 400 copies at 48 weeks, really no significant difference. In fact, the two drugs were considered to be non-inferior, with 73% of patients in the efavirenz arm versus 71% in the Maraviroc arm having well-suppressed virus at 48 weeks. However, when one looked at the proportion of patients who had less than 50 copies of virus at 48 weeks, this turned out to be 69% with efavirenz and 65% with Maraviroc. This comparison did not reach non-inferiority, and in fact, it missed it by approximately 0.9 percentage points difference. Therefore, this trial did not prove that Maraviroc was non-inferior to efavirenz at its primary endpoint of less than 50 copies at this one-year follow-up. In this study, it was more likely that patients in the efavirenz arm would discontinue therapy due to an adverse event, 13%, versus a lack of efficacy, only 4.2%. However, the opposite was seen with Maraviroc. The patients were more likely to discontinue therapy because of lack of efficacy, about 12%, versus discontinuation due to an adverse event, about 4%. What we see here is that there's a difference in efficacy, but really also a difference in terms of adverse events. The interesting thing in this study was that when one looked at the proportion of patients who had viral loads less than 50 at 48 weeks, if a patient's baseline viral load was less than 100,000 copies, really no difference between the efavirenz arm and the Maraviroc arm. However, there was evidence of a drop-off in response rate with Maraviroc at 48 weeks if a patient's viral load was greater than 100,000 copies, 67% versus 60%. Some of this may have been due to the fact that in addition to the viral load stratification of above and below 100,000, these patients were also stratified by whether they lived in the northern or southern hemisphere. This was done primarily because almost all patients enrolled in the study were enrolled in areas of the world such as North America, Western Europe, Australia, Argentina, where all patients did in fact have clade B virus. However, one of the largest enrolling centers in the southern hemisphere, namely South Africa, in that area, patients primarily have type C or clade C virus. The reason the stratification occurred, therefore, was because it was not known whether or not the difference in clade would be responsible for differences in response rate. And whether or not this did have an effect on this trial has yet to really be clearly understood. When looking at the adverse event analysis, in terms of the MERIT study, there was, in fact, a slightly increased amount of grade 3 and grade 4 adverse events associated with the efavirenz, as well as more significant serious adverse events, and also increased category C events, as well as malignancies. One important analysis that was, in fact, done later in the study of the MERIT population was to look at baseline tropism. It is true that while all patients coming into the study had to have R5 tropic virus at screening, approximately 3.5% of these patients did in fact not have R5 tropic virus at baseline, meaning that there was a shift in virus between the screening sample and the baseline sample. When one looks at the response rate in patients who had R5 tropic virus both at screening as well at baseline. The difference in terms of response rate was actually really no different between the efavirenz and maraviroc arms at 48 weeks. However, if one looks at those patients who switched, that 3.5% of patients who had R5 tropic virus at screening but had switched to X4 containing virus detected at baseline, that the response rate for both arms was in fact very different. Only 55% of patients responded in the efavirenz arm, but a very small number, only 7% of patients responded to less than 50 copies in the maraviroc arm, indicating that this change in tropism had a much greater deleterious effect in the maraviroc arm versus those patients who received efavirenz, again, as one might expect. It has been hypothesized that if the newer assay, the enhanced sensitivity assay, was used in the study, those patients would have been screened out, and if the results may have been very different in terms of non-inferiority. One thing we also learned from the MERIT study was to get a really good look at what kind of effect maraviroc may have on lipid levels. As one can see here in this next slide, while the increases that have been demonstrated before in other trials with efavirenz, we see similar sort of increases in total cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, being higher with efavirenz compared to that with maraviroc. In fact, the differences between baseline and week 48 for lipids really showed no significant difference with total cholesterol, HDL cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, or triglycerides across the board with maraviroc, indicating this drug seems to have very little, if any, effect on lipid levels whatsoever. In summary then, what I can say to you about this area of new HIV therapeutics, that chemokine co-receptors do in fact play an important role in the early steps of HIV infection, and this allows for us a new and very useful target in terms of interfering with the ability of HIV to initially infect a cell. The prevalence of viral co-receptor tropism evolves over the course of HIV infection and is associated with, although perhaps maybe or may not caused by, a decrease in CD4 cell count and also treatment experience. A tropism assay, which has now been clinically validated, is available and can detect with great sensitivity a patient's viral tropism, which can then have us better choose whether we want to use a CCR5 antagonist. Maraviroc is the first approved agent in the new class of CCR5 antagonists and has demonstrated therapeutic activity and also increase in CD4 cells in treatment-experienced patients. Its use in treatment-naive patients still remains a question to be resolved with more data over time. Nicroviroc is a CCR5 antagonist currently in development, also being studied primarily in patients who are treatment-experienced and waiting for the results of a Phase 3 trial comparing it to our first licensed agent, maraviroc. Let's next see how some of this information can be applied in everyday patient case management. And let's go through a couple of cases now. Case one, our first patient is a 37-year-old male with extensive antiretroviral therapy history dating back to when he first started medication in 1995. His past antiretroviral agents include all NRTIs except DDC, all NNRTIs except dilavudine, and all PIs except fosamprenivir and full-dose ritonavir. He has a history of buffalo hump while he was taking adenavir, which was removed in the past liposuction. He's a former participant from the RESIST-1 trial between 2003-2005, and at that time received an antiretroviral regimen of tipranovir-ritonavir, tenofovir-FTC, efavirenz, DDI, and enfuvirtide. In that study, his HIV RNA decreased from 510,000 to 5,200, and his CD4 cell increased from 75 cells to 120 cells. However, he never reached a viral load of less than 50 copies. He continued on this regimen for approximately 2.5 years, at which time he discontinued the enfuvirtide due to the lack of any available injection sites. He really had a hard time managing the medication after that 2.5 year period of time. And he continued to experience low-level viremia prior to discontinuing the enfuvirtide. The patient was also a participant in the MOTIVATE-1 trial, which evaluated maraviroc versus placebo in treatment-experienced patients. In this study, he was, as we later found out, randomized to the placebo arm with the optimized background regimen selected for him containing boosted sequenivir, combination tenofovir-FTC, DDI, and efavirenz. Although indinavir ritonavir was predicted to have full activity against this virus by baseline resistance testing, the patient refused to take this medication initially due to his prior history of lipodystrophy associated with it. After 8 weeks in the study, the patient's viral load changed very little, going from 1,162,500 copies to just 734,000 copies. This was a less than half log decrease, and therefore the patient's therapy was considered to be a virologic failure. This allowed him to be able to be switched over to open label maraviroc, which was dosed at 150 milligrams twice a day. And at this point, he did accept the medication, which genotypically and phenotypically looked the best for his virus, boosted indinavir, and continued on tenofovir FTC and DDI. On this regimen, he achieved a viral load less than 50 copies by week 24, and his CD4 cells increased to 155 cells, 22% of total lymphocytes, and maintained this for the next 6 months. But another complication soon came up, and at that time, he developed bilateral hip pain. Orthopedic diagnosis resulted in finding advanced aseptic necrosis of the right hip, and for this problem, he underwent right total hip replacement surgery. Moving on to our next slide. So at this time, would you consider this a good reason to change a patient's therapy? He is, in fact, undetectable on the current regimen of maraviroc, boosted indinavir, combination tenofovir FTC plus DDI, but he has had a significant complication which may or may not have been related to his indinavir therapy, namely aseptic necrosis of his right hip. There are many ways the situation could be handled because the patient is not experiencing virologic failure. It is, in fact, the first time that his HIV has been suppressed to less than 50 copies ever in his over 10-year history of antiretroviral medication. But we're concerned that because he reluctantly received the medication indinavir in the first place because of a previous history of lipodystrophy and now has developed a new complication which might be related to this medication, namely aseptic necrosis of his hip, his adherence to the medication may not be so good. In fact, he's been commenting to you that this is something that may be a problem. So there are strong reasons on both sides for why it would be a good idea to change a medication regimen or not. Well, we go on and we find that what we want to do, first of all, is to try to maintain the viral load, and we convince the patient to remain on his current regimen to maintain his HIV RNA less than 50 copies. However, over the next several weeks, you note that the HIV RNA increases initially to 580 copies per milliliter, and then on repeat testing up to 1,280 copies per milliliter. You suspect that the patient's confidence in his antiretroviral therapy regimen is waning due to his concern about hip surgery on his right hip and possibilities of the same on his left hip. You determine that a change in his regimen is in fact indicated, and you order a new genotype, phenotype, and a tropism test because he now has detectable virus on which you can get a better look of what his viral characteristics are all about. The results of the tropism test indicate that the patient's virus, which was initially R5 tropic before he went on the MOTIVATE study in 2005, is still R5 tropic, indicating that maraviroc would still be a useful agent against this patient's virus. The patient's genotype phenotype is shown on this next slide. As you can see, there are few choices for therapy from the three classes of medications on this genotype phenotype. We see that there are multiple mutations in the reverse transcriptase gene affecting both nucleosides and non-nucleosides, and multiple mutations within the protease gene as well. Only one medication, tenofovir, demonstrates any activity based upon phenotype. We are a bit concerned, however, in reading this test because of the fact that the patient does have in his genotype mutations at positions 41, 210, and 215, which genotypically, and as this report indicates, predicts resistance to tenofovir. The fact that he also has an additional thymidine analog mutation, a TAM, at position 67 is also of concern. However, the phenotype is saying that there's not only susceptibility, but perhaps even hypersusceptibility of this patient's virus to this drug. So this may be one medication that we could, in fact, continue based upon what other drugs we could use with it. We see that on this particular resistance testing, that because he has five NNRTI-associated mutations, all first-generation NNRTIs are no longer effective against this virus. What effect a new medication like etravirine will have against this virus is not shown on this particular genotype, phenotype, but we will pick it up in just a minute. And as we can see here at the bottom of the genotype, phenotype readout, he has 13 protease inhibitor mutations, with many primary mutations, particularly at sites 33, 47, 54, and 90. This, of course, presents a rather concerning picture because every protease inhibitor on the list there has been shown to be associated with high-level resistance. Some of the genotypes are showing that there may be some susceptibility, such as with fosamprenivir, both boosted and unboosted, but really no other indication that there's susceptibility in this class whatsoever. So let's move on. First question we'll ask, because boosted PIs have been a cornerstone of many of our regimens for persons with high treatment experience, should we include a boosted PI in this regimen, looking at this particular phenotype, genotype below? Yes, perhaps so, because even though there is high-level resistance here, perhaps using a medication in this class may have some partial benefit, particularly in coordination with other medications used. We see that genotypically there's some activity with fosamprenivir, although phenotypically none. And even our newest protease inhibitor, darunavir, is shown to have a fold change of over 100, greater than its upper cutoff. So this is, I think, a real difficult situation, whether or not in continuing a boosted PI would be of any help at all. The other situation we're dealing with, of course, is the fact this patient is currently still on endenavir with ritonavir. And as our genotype-phenotype shows, both genotypically and phenotypically, there is no susceptibility to this medication. And he could have, in fact, have had a significant adverse event, namely the right hip aseptic necrosis. So I can see good reasons why continuing this class of medication probably is not going to be very effective and, in fact, may only be fraught with more toxicity for him. If we were going to include a PI, however, which one would we actually include in that regimen? This is a really difficult situation because based upon the PIs on this phenotype, genotype, none are shown to have significantly good activity. The best way for us to try to really look at this may be if we were to try to include one that may be close in terms of its upper cutoff. And we really don't see that there's a great activity in any of the PIs, except for maybe endenavir, which is the one the patient will no longer take because of adverse events. So I think this is really going to be a tough situation to say yes as to which boosted PI, in fact, may be helpful. The next question to address in this patient's regimen selection is, what do we switch the nucleoside component of this patient's regimen? He is currently on combination tenofovir plus FTC, and it does show that his virus is susceptible to tenofovir by phenotypic testing. The one thing we'd want to do is continue the tenofovir FTC because there's some activity there. This may be occurring because the M184 mutation that he has may in fact suppress some of the action of the mutations on tenofovir, which is why the genotype is showing resistance, but the phenotype, which can actually demonstrate interaction between mutations, shows sensitivity. The continuation of DDI really looks pretty much ineffective. There is no activity of this medication, and continuing it may, in fact, be only fraught with more problems. However, probably the best thing to do here, because we do have some glimmer of activity with tenofovir, is continue him on tenofovir FTC, continuing the FTC not so much because it's going to have any significant activity against this virus, but primarily because of the fact that the mutation, the M184V that FTC will confer, is something that could in fact be helpful in maintaining susceptibility to the tenofovir. Next question is, how about new classes? Would we want to include raltegravir, our initially licensed integrase inhibitor in this patient's regimen? This is a situation where I think because of the lack of good options from our initial three classes that we use, nucleosides, non-nucleosides, and protease inhibitors, that the answer has to be an overwhelming yes. Raltegravir is going to be assumed to be highly active against this virus because it's never received an integrase inhibitor before, and therefore I think including it would definitely be a good idea. What do we include etravirine in this patient's regimen? Although our older type of genotype phenotype did not specifically include etravirine on it, this patient has at least three NNRTI mutations that are considered to be resistance-associated mutations for this drug. Let's look at a little bit of new information that just became of light about resistance in enterovirine. At the International Resistance Workshop for HIV in the summer of 2008, the clinical cutoffs for the phenotypic susceptibility for enterovirine were in fact established. An additional four enterovirine mutations were identified, increasing the number from 13 up to 17. And most importantly, a weighted scoring system was developed to really help us understand that all mutations that affect enterovirine of that list of 17 are not equal. First of all, let's look at the new mutations that were, in fact, added. We see that mutations at positions 136, 230, the K101H, a new substitution at the same site of the K101 position, and also a mutation at the 170 site, were added to the list of 13, making this a total of 17. But more importantly, what we've also noticed by more information about enterovirine resistance, that certain mutations have more effect against this drug than others. For example, we know that the mutations that occur at position 181, particularly the Y181C and Y181I, have more effect against enterovirine than other mutations, such as G190A. So again, this is something where the weighted scoring system has, in fact, come in be handy. This slide really shows what the weighted scoring system is all about for this drug. As we can see, the Y181I, Y181V are considered to be significant mutations against enterovirine carrying a weight of 3, whereas mutations like the V179T or G190A are given a weight of 1. When we add up all the mutations that occur in this patient's particular genotype, including a Y181C given a weight of 2.5, a K101H given a weight of 1, and also a G190A given a weight of 1, add all this up, and we do in fact get a score of 4.5. Based upon the results from the DUET 1 and 2 studies, we see that in patients who have scoring systems weighted up to as high as 4.5, that the response rate was in fact reduced to be 38% or less, indicating that enterovirine is not going to be too promising. So the next question we'll ask in terms of constructing this regimen is, would we continue the Maraviroc in this patient's new regimen? The patient's been on Maraviroc for approximately 3 years now. It has continued to be effective until the patient, perhaps through his own lack of good adherence, broke through with a low-level viremia of around 1,500 copies. New tropism testing does, in fact, however, show that the majority of the patient's virus with the new profile enhanced sensitivity test is, in fact, R5 tropic. The new enhanced tropism test can, in fact, detect down to a level of 0.3% of a patient's virus being X4, the type of virus that Maraviroc will not work against. Therefore, with over a 99.7% sensitivity, we can feel sure this patient's virus is still susceptible to Maraviroc, and therefore continuing it in his new regimen would be a good idea. So on his new regimen, we decide to give him Maraviroc, Darunavir, and enterovirine, based upon the good results that this combination had from the DUET 1, DUET 2 studies. Although we're not going to have full activity of either agent, we are a bit concerned about not having some more potent agents in this patient's regimen, and of course also adding raltegravir. We decide to also continue the patient on tenofovir FTC. On this regimen, the patient's HIV RNA drops again below 50 copies, and CD4 cells slowly rise to over 280 cells, 28% of total lymphocytes, over the next 8 months. His left hip pain and MRI of it stabilized, showing no further progression, and he continues to tolerate this antiretroviral regimen well. Our best guesses here of using two active drugs, Maraviroc and raltegravir based upon assumption of susceptibility, Maraviroc based upon demonstration of susceptibility, as well as what we can define as perhaps full susceptibility with tenofovir, and the addition of darunavir and enterovirine seem to have worked. Our ability to get the patient's viral load less than 50, get him off of what we consider to be offending boosted protease inhibitor and denivir has been associated with improvement of not only the viral load and CD4 cell count, but also improvement of the concerning hip problem that has been a problem for him in terms of it remaining adherent. We'll continue to follow this patient over time and see whether or not we need to maintain all these particular agents. In the future, there may be opportunity if necessary, for simplification of this patient's regimen by perhaps being able to discontinue etravirine or darunavir if side effects occur. Let's go on to case two. In this case, we have a 45-year-old man who was diagnosed with HIV in 1994 when he first presented to his doctor with cutaneous Kaposi's sarcoma. At that time, his CD4 cell count was 360 cells per cubic millimeter. Unfortunately, because HIV RNA testing was not available in 1994, we don't have an initial HIV RNA to work with. His past medical history included mild hypertension, which was well controlled with diuretics, and he had a family history of both diabetes and cardiovascular disease. His antiretroviral history began in 1994 with AZT monotherapy. He took this because the Kaposi's sarcoma diagnosis also gave him a diagnosis of AIDS, and for that reason, AZT was recommended. However, he had to stop the AZT about 6 months into the therapy due to progressive anemia and nausea. He then went on to DDI monotherapy, the second agent licensed in the early 90s. He tolerated the DDI monotherapy for 9 months, but then developed chronic pancreatitis with elevated pancreatic enzymes and abdominal pain. He discontinued all antiretrovirals then because his Kaposi's sarcoma had been quiescent, no new lesions, and his CD4 cell count was stable at 360 cells. Again, viral load testing was not available at that time. Starting in 1996, he began a series of various regimens. Of course, this was very typical of the early heart era when new medications became available, and they were oftentimes added sequentially and usually not in very good order because we didn't know what medication sequencing was, in fact, most effective. So during this period of time, he first of all began his first heart regimen with a combination of D4T, 3TC, and sequenivir. That was followed by a single substitution of the sequenivir for nalfenivir. Next, the D4T was switched to abacavir, 3TC was maintained, and he began taking efavirenz. Finally, we switched back to D4T, 3TC with a first combination boosted PI, lopinavir, ritonavir. When tenofovir became available as well as fosamprenavir, he was switched from D4T to tenofovir, maintained the 3TC, maintained the lopinavir, ritonavir, and added fosamprenavir, being on a dual boosted PI regimen at that time. Let's review what kind of intolerance he's had to his antiretrovirals. We know that he was intolerant to zidovudine due to anemia, intolerant to DDI due to pancreatitis, and while on D4T developed peripheral neuropathy. Nalfenivir caused significant diarrhea, as well as significant GI symptoms, including bloating and abdominal cramps, with the dual boosted PIs of his last regimen. His HIV RNA had reached less than 400 copies on a few occasions, but had never become less than 50 copies. In terms of his resistance testing over this period of time, his first genotypic assay after failure of the D4T, 3TC, and sequenivir showed mutations in the reverse transcriptase gene at positions 41, 74, 184, and 215, as one might expect, as well as in the protease gene at positions 10, 63, and 90, again, as one might expect in response to the sequenivir. His second genotypic test after failure of the abacavir, 3TC, and efavirenz showed continued increase in the mutations in the RT gene, including in positions 41, 74, 101, K103N, Y181C, M184V, 215, and 219. He also had developed more mutations in the PR gene, most likely related to his previous use of nalfenivir. During this time, his CD4 cell count rose and fell and had reached a nadir of 240 cells at one point. So now it's 2008. The patient is currently on a regimen of tenofovir, 3TC, and lopinavir-ritonavir. His HIV RNA has been at a low level of persistent viremia of between 1,500 and 2,500 copies per ml, and his current CD4 cell count has been somewhere between 300 and 350 cells per cubic millimeter. Other medical problems have progressed as well. His hypertension has now become poorly controlled with an ACE inhibitor, diuretic combination, as well as a beta blocker. We test his fasting glucose and find it to be over 180 milligrams per deciliter, indicating pre-diabetic abnormalities. And his serum creatinine, which previously had been in a baseline between 1.0 up to 1.4 milligrams per deciliter, is now 1.9 milligrams per deciliter, and starting to raise some concern. The patient has read about new medications being available, particularly of new classes, and he wants to consider a new regimen based upon the fact that he knows that the persistent, although low level viremia, is not a good idea for him. So we get a phenotype, shown on this next slide, demonstrates some good news, even though he does have both present mutations at 41, 74, 184V, 215, and 219, that there's some activity still with zidovudine, D4T, and tenofovir. We know that his tolerance of D4T and zidovudine has not been good in the past, even though the higher doses of zidovudine were used in the past, up to 1,200 milligrams a day, which may have been part of the reason he could not tolerate it. But we're concerned about using either one of those medications. The only medication that may be of use for him is going to be the tenofovir. In the Indian RTI class, he has mutations at K101P and also K103S. The K103S is, in fact, an intermediate for the K103N mutation. All first-generation Indian RTIs show high-level resistance. We'll have to see what we can count up in terms of mutations for etravirine. And finally, in the class of protease inhibitors, while he has 10 protease inhibitor mutations, and particularly major mutations at sites 33, 54, 84, and 90, there is high-level resistance to many of the protease inhibitors, but some intermediate susceptibility to darunavir, indicating that with a fold change on the phenotype of 17 falling above the lower cutoff but below the upper cutoff of 40, that there is suspected to be some intermediate susceptibility to this agent. Let's look at the viral tropism test. Although it is treatment experienced, his CD4 cell count is over 300, so the possibilities that his virus will be R5 tropic are still pretty good. We get a tropism test and find that the majority of his virus is R5 tropic, predicting that maraviroc should be highly active against his virus. And looking specifically at our two newest protease inhibitors, darunavir or tipranavir, ones that historically have had the best susceptibility in situations in which patients have had high treatment experience with boosted PIs, we see that just focusing in on these two agents, that while there are mutations that this patient has that are overlapping that confer resistance to both of these drugs, looking to darunavir resistance mutations, particularly mutations at positions 33 and 84, these mutations also have activity against tipranavir. The mutation at 54V also has a resistance profile against tipranavir, indicating he has two darunavir mutations, three tipranavir mutations, and the phenotype does in fact support some activity with darunavir. We find that the phenotypic fold change at 10 is above the upper cutoff of 8 for the drug, indicating that probably there's going to be very little good susceptibility to this agent. So picking darunavir boosted with ritonavir would probably be the best medication we could use from that class here. Our next question is, should we use a nucleoside analog agent or two in this regimen? Yes or no? This is becoming an increasingly important question because in many of our highly treatment-experienced patients like this individual who has had not only resistance but also side effects to many NRTIs, to many nucleosides, the continuation of drugs from this class sometimes may or may not make sense at all. This is where I think that we're starting to change that paradigm of always continuing to use what we used to call the backbone of dual nucleosides in patients who have high treatment experience. Reviewing our phenotypic information, we see that patient's virus has susceptibility to tenofovir, zidovudine, and D4T. However, we know that there's been significant problems with zidovudine and D4T in the past. We're a little concerned about the change in his renal function, although we don't know exactly where that's coming from. So this is a question, I guess, that really could go either way, depending upon how many other agents we have available to us from our current armamentarium. This really brings up a very important question. How many additional active agents does this patient need to get his viral load less than 50? Again, remember, this patient has never had a viral load less than 50 copies. And therefore, in looking at what we now have available to us, we would predict that maraviroc would be a fully active agent based upon the tropism test showing an R5 virus. We would predict that raltegravir would be a fully active agent based upon assumed susceptibility because he's never been on an integrase inhibitor before. But we don't know about etravirine, and we really have some concerns about darunavir ritonavir because of the intermediate resistance we have to that agent and no clear phenotype with etravirine. So let's look at a little bit of data of whether we need one, two, three, or more than three active agents to suppress a patient's virus with this much treatment experience. When we look at data from the benchmark study, which evaluated the use of an optimized background regimen based upon resistance testing and allowed our newest protease inhibitor, darunavir-ritonavir or tipranavir-ritonavir, in the regimen, and then used placebo or raltegravir, we see that as the number of active agents in the background regimen increased from 0 to 1 to 2 by the phenotypic analysis with a PSS shown on this slide, there was an increasingly good response in proportion of patients who had viral loads less than 50 copies at 24 weeks of treatment, going from 61% to 79%, up to 87%. However, by the genotypic analysis, we see that there was a leveling off between 1 and 2 active agents there at 71%, indicating that by adding more active agents in the background regimen to raltegravir, no particular improvement seemed to happen. So again, a little bit of controversial data there. Let's also look at the DUET-1, DUET-2 study. This study allowed all patients to be on darunavir-ritonavir-based regimen as part of their optimized background therapy, and then added either a placebo or etrovirine to that. In terms of the phenotypic susceptibility score of the background agents, there's a fairly clear topping out between 2 and 3, that by adding 3 active agents in the background regimen to etrovirine, no further improvement really occurs. And finally, when we look at the MOTIVATE-1, MOTIVATE-2 studies, the studies that evaluated the use of maraviroc either at once-a-day or twice-a-day dosing, as shown on this slide, compared to a placebo in context of an optimized background regimen. However, of note, these regimens could not contain darunavir because of lack of drug interaction data. We see that, again, the same sort of situation is being seen. While just focusing on the twice-a-day dosing maraviroc increases from 29% less than 50 to 43% to 53% to only a small increase of 58% as the agents increase from 0, 1, 2, or 3 in the optimized background regimen. All these clinical trials only allowed one investigational agent. What our opportunity will be at adding multiple agents from new classes together may in fact be able to get past this apparent ceiling of between 60 to 70% response rate with these agents individually. So let's ask some questions here. Which regimen would we choose for this patient? We've decided to keep the patient on tenofovir FTC because of the activity of the tenofovir seen there. We've also decided to include darunavir-ritonavir based upon the fact that it does have some partial activity. And what are we going to add to that? We have what we consider to be full activity with tenofovir, partial activity with boosted darunavir, and adding other agents are shown here. Etrovirine plus maraviroc, maraviroc plus raltegravir, etrovirine plus raltegravir, or in fact all three, etrovirine, maraviroc, and raltegravir. Again, this is becoming, I think, a situation in which while we have the luxury of having many new active medications for these highly experienced patients, there has not been a clear indication of how those agents may be used most effectively. Many physicians are now left to their own devices in this way because clinical trial data have really been very few and far between in terms of suggesting how many new agents we really need. In this patient, it was decided to actually use all the agents, tenofovir FTC, darunavir-ritonavir, etrovirine, maraviroc, and raltegravir, because of the fact it was concerned that there may be some decreased response to the etrovirine. We did, in fact, choose correctly because the patient's viral load dropped to less than 50 copies at 6 weeks. CD4 cell a few weeks later was actually increasing to 420. However, we encountered an adverse event of concern. The serum creatinine was now increasing to 2.7 from the previous 1.9, and a measured creatinine clearance of 24-hour urine collection showed creatinine clearance to be 48 mils per minute. What do we do next with the tenofovir FTC? Do we continue it on a once-a-day basis? We're doing now? Do we follow the renal dosing guidelines and reduce the dose to every other day? Do we perhaps switch the medication from tenofovir FTC to a Bacavir 3TC, or do we just discontinue the nucleosides altogether? In this case, I think the fact that we were continuing it based upon weak data to begin with from our phenotypic data only, and because we've now encountered a significant side effect, stopping the medication would probably be the best way to go here. I think it would be of concern to drop the dose to every other day because of the fact this patient has other particular concerning effects on his kidneys, particularly long-standing hypertension, now indicating diabetes, that may in fact say that he will not do well with another possible renal toxin added to it. Abacavir did not in fact show good activity against this virus on the last genotype we had. So we decided to stop the tenofovir altogether, keep him on the regimen of darunavir, ritonavir, etravirine, or avaroc and maltegravir. His viral load remains less than 50 copies. His CD4 cell count continues to increase to 550 cells, and thankfully his creatinine does drop back down to 1.8, and his 24-hour collection shows a creatinine clearance of increasing up to 80 mils per minute. So in this case, we actually were able to, by trial and error, improve in this patient's therapy to suppress his viral load effectively with new agents, avert some toxicity associated with old agents, and offer him something that could be very promising for the future. Let me now take some questions that have been collected by the Body Pro website involving viral tropism and the use of CCR5 antagonists. The question is, has anyone who was being treated with a CCR5 antagonist, in this case either maraviroc or vicrovirok through a clinical trial, developed West Nile virus or severe complications associated with it? Let me just expand a little bit on my comments about the association of the patients who are known to be CCR5 homozygotes for the deleted gene, meaning they have no CCR5 molecules on the surface of their T cells or other immune cells like macrophages, and West Nile virus. What is known really in a handful of patients, and as I've looked at the literature about this, I've really found less than 5 case reports of patients who are homozygous genetically and who have developed West Nile and have developed more significant neurologic disease associated with it, which is considered to be a more serious sort of problem with West Nile virus. To my knowledge, there has been no patient in a clinical trial with either maraviroc or vicrovirok or in clinical practice with maraviroc who's developed West Nile or any serious complications from it. This is probably because of the fact that while maraviroc is somewhat like a genetically homozygous deleted patient for CCR5, it's not exactly like that. That means that these patients still probably have some expression of CCR5 on some of their immune cells. As good as maraviroc or vicrovirok could ever be, it could not, in fact, completely block all CCR5 molecules on the surface of the cell, so that there's still ability for these immune cells to use that coreceptor in a way that immune defenses could, in fact, be continued. That's my hypothesis about it anyway. Clinically, I do not know of any increase in West Nile virus with these two agents. The question is the new tropism enhanced sensitivity test sensitive enough in terms of now more accurately identifying patients who may have some X4 virus in the viral population? With a significant improvement in the ability of the assay to detect very low levels of X4 virus, meaning down to 0.3% of the entire viral population, and some of the clinical uses of this assay in terms of going back and looking at some of those trials in which the older assay was used and did in fact miss some of the patients that did have X4, but the older assay failed to identify them. And this assay has in fact been about 70% effective in being able to identify X4 virus in those patients. So the assay, I think, is going to be and is doing a much better job at finding X4 virus and letting the treating physician know about it. My concern about it is that it may actually go the other way, that it may be too sensitive, and that what we may be seeing here is that, similar to what we've seen with minority variant populations of viruses, in which very low levels of perhaps NNRTI resistance mutations have been seen, that even though those mutations are there, they do not always predict that a patient will fail an NNRTI-based regimen. Now, we don't know with 100% sensitivity that this is in fact occurring yet, as this assay has only really been out available for 3 months in the United States. It came out in June of 2008. But what we do know is that it is doing a very good job of finding very, very low levels of X4, and I think with that, we're going to be able to use agents like maraviroc and vicrovirok much, much more effectively. The question is a second clinical trial in treatment-naive patients going to be done with maraviroc with the more sensitive assay? One would think, based upon that analysis, that post-hoc analysis from the MERIT study, in which it was determined that patients did in fact have switching between screening and baseline, that perhaps a second study would in fact be more effectively done with the new assay, excluding those patients that did in fact have some low-level X4 virus that wasn't detected in the first trial. I doubt that the companies that are making these agents will want to repeat a study as large as the merit trial. The expenditures to do that trial, especially on an international basis, were, I'm sure, tremendous. Probably what's going to happen is that maraviroc will continue to be studied in naive patients in a different way, coupled with a more novel sort of regimen, perhaps with a unboosted protease inhibitor, perhaps boosted with one nucleoside analog, perhaps compared with one of our new second-generation NNRTIs like etravirine, in a way that will look at maraviroc in treatment-naive patients, but in a different fashion than the MERIT study did, putting it together in a more updated and more current sort of regimen. Of course, the tropism enhanced sensitivity assay will, in fact, be used and will really, I think, give us a much better population, a more well-defined population of patients to study with this kind of agent. So look for that in the future. The question is, who is the best patient for the use of a CCR5 antagonist? Well, the ideal patient, I think, you know, in terms of all things considered, would be the patient that is probably as close to their infection with HIV as possible, meaning that those are the patients who have the highest likelihood of having R5 tropic virus, where this medication seems to work best. The place where the drug has been used most commonly and is actually approved for usage right now is in the highly treatment-experienced patients, where patients actually need a brand-new agent. You know, where I have been finding it's used to be the most beneficial right now is really not in the salvage-type patient, those who have very little of any kind of medication regimens available to them, as was studied in the MOTIVATE trial, because oftentimes what we're seeing there is that the chances that that patient has an R5 tropic virus is really falling down pretty low, sometimes less than 30-40%. Probably the better place to use this agent would be, say, after the second regimen fails, and the probability of a patient's virus being R5 tropic is much higher than waiting for the 5th, 6th, 7th regimen to fail. At that point, that patient has already gone through basically two nucleoside backbones, usually an NNRTI and a boosted PI. You know, this may be the perfect place to use maraviroc because of the fact that the chances of having the right kind of virus is going to be there, the toxicity profile of the drug seems to be very good, and that it can be coupled with many other agents because the drug-drug interactions have been clearly worked out, and the fact that, you know, a new agent could be used very effectively at that point. Basically, what I say is that as soon as I do the tropism assay and find the patient has R5 tropic virus, that's when I use the medication. Waiting to use the medication and hoping that that assay is going to continue to show the same result could be a big problem. This is where I'll end. I hope you were able to learn something new from this presentation and be able to use this information to treat your patients better.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us. Thank you for listening to this CME CE presentation from The Body Pro. Be sure to visit us online for more continuing education activities at www.thebodypro.com/CME.